On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up to the new equation.
We're joined on the line now by Chris Rapley, who's a professor of climate science in the Department of Earth Sciences at University College London. Chris Rapley, thank you for joining us this lunchtime. Do you share some of that optimism that something meaningful could be achieved this month?
Yeah. I adopt a position of stubborn optimism. I think that's a phrase first coined by Cristiana Figueres, but it seems to me to be a good stance under the circumstances.
Why the optimism? Why so stubborn, and why not in the face of so many large countries not sending their biggest and boldest and most powerful?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that there's a big hill to climb with this conference. And it's also true that we're past the age of three-word slogans and kind of targets set, you know, 10, 20, 30 years out. What we're looking for are detailed action plans that show how we're going to get from A to B. The key issue is that with fossil fuel use, the latest research shows that for a 50-50 chance of hitting that guardrail of 1.5 degrees that was agreed 6 years ago in Paris at COP21, it's necessary to leave 60% of known oil and gas reserves in the ground and 90% of coal reserves. And yet we know that the oil and gas companies are still investing in looking for new reserves. You know why? So what we want to see is concrete plans that start tomorrow, because, you know, starting in 10 years' time isn't the issue. We want to see action that is credible action that takes us from where we are to where we need to be, which is to abolish fossil fuels as quickly as we can. That's it. The time has come for convincing action.
Well, then I suppose that the issue we have, and I don't mean to immediately try to rain on the parade or to try and inject pessimism again, but that unless every country, particularly those that are responsible for larger emissions, makes meaningful commitments, then doesn't every other country have an excuse not to do the same? So you can have large countries that'll say, well, what's the point in us trying to do anything or being more aggressive if China hasn't yet committed to being net zero by 2050? Or why should we have to do something if Jair Bolsonaro, you know, who took a hands-off approach when there was wildfires in the Amazon a couple of years ago, if he doesn't necessarily believe in climate change or isn't willing to do much about it, that if someone else isn't going to, then why would everyone else feel like they have to pick up the mantle?
Well, I think it's certainly true that in all human affairs, and particularly political ones, fairness is an absolutely crucial issue. So people are unwilling or unhappy about taking action if they feel that it's unfair, that other people aren't. So you're quite right. That will be a major challenge for this COP26 to gather together a set of agreements that most people feel are fair. There are some real problems. How do you do what I was just saying, transform from a fossil fuel-based energy system to a green energy system without disrupting communities, disrupting countries' national budgets and so on? So that's why it's so important that people get into the detail and work collectively together. This is the greatest collective action in history. It's a struggle for humanity to operate in that way, particularly because the world is sort of increasingly divisive. And if I might just pick up on that, you know, people say, oh, this is the, you know, last chance saloon, category red and so on. Mm-hmm. I mean, every tenth of a degree matters. So 2.6 degrees is better than 2.7 degrees, 2.5 degrees, you know, and so on. But the point is, we need to start to see that action now. And so if some people aren't contributing, you know, we're all affected by climate change. It's a threat multiplier to the stability of the world. So if others aren't going to join in, then set an example and draw them along through sheer embarrassment.
I see The Guardian reporting, and this has been sent in by Jerry, who's used our hashtag on the record NT. He says, The Guardian's reporting, just observing today, I don't think it's new information, but the likes of Royal Dutch and BP, some of the larger fossil fuel extractors, they produce five times more greenhouse gases each year than Great Britain does, which makes you wonder then how much of an appetite there is, or how possible it is for a summit like this to result in a proper unified global approach to make sure that big countries like that are brought to heel. Because again, if you don't have every partner on board, board, then there's always going to be some legal loophole or some void somewhere that those companies are going to exploit.
Yeah, it's certainly true decisions made in the boardroom of major oil companies will have a bigger impact on the future of humanity and the future of this issue than decisions made in the governments of many, many countries. So, and it's interesting, isn't it, that those companies have the financial capital, the human capital, the engineering skill, the global reach. If they make the right decisions, then the world will transform so much more quickly. So it's hugely important, what decisions they make and that we hold them to account. In the meantime, it's also true that governments have an extremely important role to play in the kind of legal framework under which they operate, so that, again, it's a level playing field and a fair game.
Without trying to get into the weeds then of how these summits sort of actually work, because people might see a lot of stuff on the news in a couple of days and it'll just be world leaders delivering addresses at podiums and it might not feel like there's very much talking. You might give people some sense of how much talking or what forums there are for actual negotiation behind the scenes.
Oh, well, I went to COP25 in Paris and was kind of loosely attached to one of the delegations. And of course, the term is Sherpas, if that's a good term or not. But essentially, the civil servants who are working out the detail work 24/7. And I mean, you know, they are very informed, very smart people who've been dealing with this issue for a long time. They know the long history of where the roadblocks are, you know, where the problems are, where potential solutions are. So that effort, it's like the swan gliding on the surface, you know, they're the legs paddling frantically underneath. And that's where the detail is hammered out. And the politicians, posture on top, no doubt, decisions by them can be very influential, but built on a solid base of the hard work of those teams.
As it just happens, in the minutes while you've just been talking, I've just got a usual promotion email that I get from the New York Times, and they're including a little bit of an excerpt from their editorial this time, and they're saying that although COP21, the one you just mentioned, which came up with the commitment to 1.5 degrees, it says that those Paris Climate Accords didn't go far enough, but that the backdrop is different this time because, for starters, the science of climate change has become tighter, tougher and more terrifying, and that might just jolt world leaders from their stasis. But yet we also have, you know, a summer of disasters and chilling warnings and wildfires and flooding, all of which is very uncharacteristic. You would think that maybe people shouldn't have needed the prompt of a global summit. That do they need to see the disasters unfolding before them before they take action? Or is that just necessary that you have to show people what's going to happen? You need to give them a preview of the dystopia before they chip in.
Well, unfortunately, it's a sort of aspect of human nature, isn't it? There's good evolutionary reasons why the Mark One brain that we're all equipped with tends to say, well, let's wait and see, let's wait and see. That's quite a good strategy in many circumstances, of normal life. But unfortunately, with climate change, if you wait long enough to be absolutely sure that you've got a problem, it gets a bit late to do something about it. And unfortunately, that's where we've come. But it's interesting, isn't it, that for 30 years before Paris, the nations of the world were arguing about, is this a problem? Do you think we should take it seriously? The turning point at Paris was, they said, even then, before we had all of these extraordinary extreme events over the last couple of years, they said, you know what? The scientific evidence is strong enough that we do have to take this seriously and we will commit to doing something about it. So here we are 6 years later. And the question before the House is, okay, so what? What are you going to do about it? And some nations have stepped up to the bar and they're coming forward with pretty clear plans. I have to say that China, that doesn't get a very good press, is actually pretty impressive, because what we know is that what they have committed to, even if we might have wished for more, they're very likely to deliver, given their political system and the way they function and the way their leaders, by and large, have a science or engineering background. So they kind of get this stuff firsthand rather than having to be briefed on
it.
So it's a mixed bag, but the situation has changed. And as you say, the general public, if you look at the polls, whereas climate change was a taboo subject, people didn't want to talk about it. a few years ago, even 2 or 3 years ago, there's been this constant drumbeat of wildfires and floods and extreme storms and so on. So it's very few people these days who would say, oh, I don't think it's a real problem. They all see it as a high problem and they all want something done about it. So this is the right moment for, democratically elected politicians to take advantage of that and get stuck in.
This is perhaps an unusual way to finish an interview like this, Chris, but a few years ago, you wrote a book called 2071, The World That Will Leave Our Grandchildren. And 2071 was the year that you chose because it was the year that your own grandchildren would be when they got to your age at the time of publication, which is a very powerful but very tangible concept. And it made me think of when my daughters, a daughter who was born last month and then another one or 2 years ago, made me think that when they got to my age, which will be in the 2050s, it certainly brings home the stakes that we're talking about. Now, I know the book was also developed as a play and the closing words that you wrote then I think are still pertinent today. So if you don't mind, can we finish the interview with you reading those words for us, please?
I'd love to. And just very quickly, when we wrote the play, carbon dioxide concentration of the atmosphere was 380 parts per million. It's now, 398 parts per million. It's now 414. And the global temperature rise was 0.8 of a degree. It's now 1.1. It doesn't seem very long ago. And so I'll just read the last part of the very last words from the play. And it's relevant to this phrase you hear all the time. We're following the science. We're following the science, say the politicians. But what in the play, what I finished up with was this. Science cannot say what is right and what is wrong. Science can inform, but it cannot arbitrate. It cannot decide. Science can say that if we burn another 500 billion tons of carbon dioxide, the CO2 content of the atmosphere will increase by another 100 parts per million, and that will almost certainly lead to a warming of the planet greater than 2 degrees C, resulting in major disruption of the climate system and huge risks for the natural world and human well-being. But science cannot answer moral questions, value questions. Do we care about the world's poor? Do we care about future generations? Do we see the environment as part of the economy or the economy as part of the environment? The whole point about climate change is that despite having been revealed by science, it's not really an issue about science. It's an issue about what sort of a world we want to live in. What kind of a future do we want to create?
It's a powerful note to finish on. Chris Rapley, Professor of Climate Science at the Department of Earth Sciences at University College London and the author of 2071, The World That Will Leave Our Grandchildren. Thank you very much for talking to us this lunchtime.
On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up to the new equation.